broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we feature economic writer and columnist DeRoy Murdoch, called as a speaker to the Cato Institute, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the National Academy of Sciences. The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors.
Before I begin, I want to say a special thank you to our friends at the Indianapolis Star, because they've helped point out to all of you the writings of our speaker today. His columns appear regularly in the editorial pages of the Star, actually on a weekly basis. So thank you very much to our friends at the Star for making that possible. And because I know many of you read DeRoy Murdoch's work, I'll offer a fairly brief introduction. This is DeRoy Murdoch's second time back at this podium in 5 years. That's our way of complimenting a speaker for his excellent commentary. DeRoy is a syndicated columnist with the Scripps Howard News Service. His writing appears weekly in such publications as the New York Post, the Boston Herald, the Washington Times, and National Review, as well as, of course, our own Indianapolis Star, just to name a few. He's also a senior fellow with the Atlas Economic Research Foundation and has been a media fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. DeRoy is a native of Los Angeles. He's a graduate of Georgetown University and now what I would guess I would describe as a longtime resident of New York City, where he earned an MBA from NYU. His MBA program included a semester at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, which we actually heard a little bit about here up at our lunch conversation. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming today's guest speaker, DeRoy Murdoch.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Jamie, for that very kind introduction. Thank you to the Economic Club of Indiana for the return engagement. I guess I did okay last time. I want to say thank you to Michelle Hodge of WFYI for all of her logistical help in getting the presentation together and in getting me out here in one piece, and comfortably so. And thanks to WFYI for broadcasting this presentation. Professor Chuck Williams of Butler University was kind enough to contact me some months ago and ask me if I would appear today, so thanks to him for reaching out. Once again, thank you to the Indianapolis Star, which has run me for many years, and so if you like what I have to say today, you can read me in the Indianapolis Star. If you don't like what I have to say, then maybe you shouldn't read me in the Indianapolis Star. I want to say thank you to Chuck Preston and the folks at the Lilly Endowment, not just for their excellent work here in Indianapolis. I know they do a lot of local philanthropic work, but the Lilly Endowment supports a lot of excellent groups around the country, including the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, with which I'm a senior fellow. So thanks very much for Lilly Endowment's support. I want to say thank you also to the people at the St. Elmo's Steakhouse. I don't know if any of you are associated with St. Elmo's, but I happened to be fortunate enough to go in there for a steak about 10:30 last night. It was about the best steak I've had in 2011, so thank you to them. And last but not least, I want to thank all of you for being here. You could be doing your Christmas or Hanukkah shopping at work, tending to all of your professional duties, and yet here you are listening to me talk about public policy. So thank you very much for your kindness in being here, and also thank you and congratulations for being among the few, the proud, those who give a damn. Now, my topic today is three cheers for the rich, and I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, here's some guy from New York City who's loaded, he's got a lot of money, and here he is to defend his economic interests. And you're right. I want to show you where I live. There's my home. It's a lovely place. It has a lot of bedrooms. I've lost count how many. This actually is the Breakers. This is the home of the Vanderbilts at Newport, Rhode Island, and I have been there, but I went as a tourist, not as a resident. Where I live is much more modest. This is my estate. This is not the entire building. I just have an apartment there, which is the balcony on the right, second from the top. That's my apartment, and I share the balcony with someone else. So much more modest surroundings. Now, you may be thinking, okay, Mr. Murdoch is here to defend his parents' estate and defend all that wealth that someday may be his. Well, here's where my mom and dad live. In Temecula, California, and it's a comfortable house, but certainly not the Breakers in Newport, Rhode Island. And that car you see is not a Maserati, that is a Ford Focus. and that's the car I like to rent when I go visit my mom and dad, as I did last Christmas when this picture was taken. Now, for those of you who watch Fox Television on Sunday nights, this home may look familiar to you. This is the home of the Simpsons, and I think our home must have been designed by the same architect. So what we're going to talk about today is something that we are seeing a lot in the United States political discourse. We've heard it over the years, but I think we really have gotten a very strong dosage of it this year. And this is the sort of language and rhetoric I think you would have heard back in the 1930s, the bourgeoisie versus the proletarian workers versus the bourgeoisie, and the exploitation of the workers by the capitalist, greedy capitalists, and so on. And you see, for example, in this illustration from Melbourne University in 1933, you've got the worker there who's rolled up his sleeves, he's got his big brawny arms, and he's got his pickaxe, and he's giving it good and hard to that capitalist as the capitalist top hat flies off of his head. And you would think that based on the things you've heard in American political discourse this year, that we're back in the 30s with the same almost Marxian kind of rhetoric. And I find it very disturbing and frightening, and I think it could have very, very negative consequences. And unfortunately, it starts at the very, very top of our political hierarchy. For example, we just heard a few days ago, it was about a week ago, President Obama gave a speech in Kansas. And he said, some billionaires have a tax rate as low as 1%. 1%. That is the height of unfairness. And that speech in Kansas got a lot of attention. Well, the Washington Post took a look at that claim, and here's what they discovered. An administration official conceded the White House had no actual data to back up the president's assertion. The president is also relying on a suspect statistic about billionaires paying as little as 1% in taxes. Even if true, it is clearly a rare event. Moreover, it is certainly surprising that the White House would rely on such a dubious, unverified source for a major presidential address. And these comments appeared in an article under the headline, Obama's Kansas Speech, Some Suspect Facts. And the fact checker at the Washington Post determined that this particular statement by President Obama deserved three Pinocchios, with the Pinocchio nose coming out there. That's 3 out of 4. And when you earn 3 out of 4 Pinocchio noses, that means that what you said has contained significant factual error and or obvious contradictions. So it turns out this claim was not supported by the facts. But this is not the first time that President Obama has engaged in this kind of rhetoric. He's done quite a bit of it. For example, he said in September, I believe he's in Denver, if asking a millionaire to pay the same tax rate as a plumber makes me a warrior for the working class, I will accept that. I will wear that charge as a badge of honor. I think that's an amazing comment to hear from the president of the United States. He said the debt ceiling should not be something that is used as a gun against the heads of the American people to extract tax breaks for corporate jet owners, said President Obama as he got off of his jet. He seems upset about this corporate jet theme. He brings this up a lot, so much so that the head of the International Brotherhood of Machinists, a labor union, wrote a letter in conjunction with the head of the Private Aviation Association, asking the president to stop attacking corporate jets, fearing that people would stop buying corporate jets and the unionized workers who build them would be unemployed. I do think at a certain point you've made enough money, President Obama said April 2010. I think that's a rather revealing comment. I think when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody, said then-candidate Obama back in October of 2008. And here we have Vice President Joe Biden, one of our more outspoken public officials. And he said it's time to be patriotic, time to jump in, time to be part of the deal, time to help get America out of the rut. And the idea here is that rich people just aren't paying any taxes. They're just along for the ride while the rest of them pull them along in the chariot. Joe Biden also had an amazing comment last week. He was in Iraq, and he was there to greet the troops who were coming home at the end of the Iraq War and praising the Iraqis for having unified their country after all this strife. And he had an amazing comment, which is the following. He said, oil's the glue that's going to hold this country together. Think about that. It's really an amazing comment. Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, describes himself as a socialist, his word, not mine. When the rich get richer, they say, I am not rich enough. I need to be richer. What motivates some of these people is greed and greed and more greed. Also, Bernie Sanders saying, greed is, in my view, like a sickness. It's like an addiction. We know people on heroin. They can't stop. They need more and more. And speaking of more, here's Michael Moore, an American who's been sliding by in his good looks for decades. He said not long ago, referring to the wealthy, they're sitting on the money. That's not theirs. That's a national resource. That's ours, said Michael Moore, a man who lives in a penthouse apartment, by the way. Here we have Roseanne Barr. She said October of this year, I first would allow the guilty bankers the ability to pay back anything over $100 million personal wealth, because I believe in a maximum wage of $100 million. And if they are unable to live on that amount, then they should go to the re-education camps, and if that doesn't help, then be beheaded. So we've gone from zero to Robespierre in a matter of about 6 months or so. You see this sort of rhetoric tied into with the Occupy Wall Street movement, a lot of these protest movements. Here you have someone holding a sign that says, eat the rich, a T-shirt that says, kill and eat the rich. I found this quite frightening. Class war, we have found new homes for the rich, and all these tombstones, as if these people should be buried under the ground. Now, what I find amazing about this is not just how obnoxious this rhetoric is, but if you took out the word rich and you put kill the Jews, kill and eat the blacks, we found new homes for the gays, and you had exactly the same type of rhetoric but put in those words instead, it would be considered hate crimes. The people who said these things deservedly would find their careers at a screeching halt. If they're on television, they'd be off television. If they had newspaper columns, those no longer would be published. And some of them, in fact, might face hate crimes actions on the part of prosecutors in their jurisdictions. And yet you can say this about rich people, and people say, oh, that's pretty cool. And I don't think it is. Another comment, burn the rich, the condos. And you see the A with the circle around it. That's the anarchy sign. This is a spray paint on a wall somewhere. Well, some people don't just treat this as rhetoric. They actually start acting upon these sorts of ideas, which is a very frightening aspect of all of this. This is November 2011, just about a year ago. An arsonist burned a $500,000 home still under construction at 16 Boulder Brook Road in Sandwich, Massachusetts, a wealthy community in the Cape Cod area. And this home was under construction, and it was burned down. The fire department had to go in and put out the flames. Well, about a week later, on December 2 of 2010, an incendiary device was discovered at a home at 43 Trotters Lane in Marston Mills, Massachusetts, a few miles away from where that particular first home burned. And at Trotters Lane, somebody had graffitied F the Rich with spray paint on the fence of that home. Now, the incendiary device did not go off. It just didn't trigger, fortunately, for the people who owned it. But it turned out that that same message, F the Rich, had been graffitied at that other home that burned down. So the thinking is that this was the same person who decided this person didn't like the rich and wanted to F the rich by burning down their homes, engaging in exactly the kind of arson that you saw hinted at or even advocated when somebody wrote burn the rich as a graffito on the side of a wall. Then you had this happen a year ago today, December 14, 2010. A man by the name of Clay Duke went into the school board in Panama City, Florida, and he walked in with a gun. And here he is standing in front of the school board. You notice he's put the upside-down anarchy sign on the wall, and he's holding a gun in the faces of the school board in Panama City, Florida. And in fact, he opened fire. Now, fortunately, the members of the school board are quick enough to hide under their desks, and nobody was hurt, but his intention was to hurt or kill these people. And then he turned the gun on himself and killed himself. And the investigators and police went onto his website and discovered the following on his online manifesto. Quote, I was just born poor in a country where the wealthy manipulate, use, abuse, and economically enslave 95% of the population. Our masters, the wealthy, do as they like to us. You may recall August of this year, London exploded in fire. You had fires all across the capital of the United Kingdom. This is a particular photograph of a factory and, I believe, a warehouse and showroom for furniture built by a British family roughly about 1850 or so. And about 160 years worth of family wealth and family equity went up in flames because people decided it'd be kind of fun to see this place burn to the ground. This picture probably will win all sorts of prizes from various journalistic organizations. This is also from the London fires of August of this year. And this woman literally is jumping to save her life after her apartment building was engulfed in flames. And fortunately, some passersby caught her, and she was saved. But she literally had to jump out of a window to prevent being burned to death. And various people at the BBC asked folks, why are you doing this? Why are you burning down this city, this beautiful, magnificent, great, grandiose, gracious, and elegant city of London where we all live? And one of them said, we're just showing rich people we can do what we want. So again, let's hurt the rich, let's put the rich in their place, and let's set fires. So this is very, very dangerous and deadly rhetoric in which people are engaging. Now, when I defend the rich and I say three cheers for the rich, I'm not referring to someone like Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff is a crook. Bernie Madoff is a criminal. Bernie Madoff is a convict, and he's in jail where he belongs. He likely will die there, and I hope he's very uncomfortable. He robbed his clients of approximately $13 billion. To me, the most interesting one is Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Prize winner. He won the Nobel Peace Prize. And Elie Wiesel is a survivor of Auschwitz. Elie Wiesel survived Auschwitz. He survived Adolf Hitler, only to be turned around and robbed blind by Bernie Madoff. So Bernie Madoff deserves whatever discomfort he's feeling as a guest of the federal government today. So I'm not defending people like him. nor am I defending bailouts, this bailout culture that developed after the 2008 economic crisis. Big companies like AIG, which got something like $182 billion in your money and our money because they made very stupid and foolish investments. I believe in the free markets. That means that you make the money on the way up if things go well, and you suffer the losses on the way down. And if you suffer the losses, you can cry and moan, but don't come to the taxpayers for help. That's your responsibility. We will cross our fingers and hope you get out of it, but don't expect us to write you a check for $182 billion. I'm not defending that either. Nor am I defending the kind of corporate welfare we see throughout many industries, such as the peanut industry, the ethanol industry, and even the sugar industry, where you basically cannot operate without the assistance of the federal government, without all sorts of subsidies. Even if you want to avoid them, you often have to take them. And I'm opposed to this. It's a waste of taxpayers' money. It distorts markets, and we should end this sort of thing. So I'm not talking about cheering for the rich in that regard. Now, this gap is something you hear about, this ongoing theme you hear from, for example, Congressman James Clyburn, who's the third-ranking Democrat in the House after Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer. And he said in July of this year, 98% of the American people are carrying this tax load, while the other 2% seem to be getting away scot-free, and that's not fair. And again, you hear this from the left over and over and over again, that the top 1%, top 2%, they're not doing anything, they're not paying any taxes, and the other 98% pulling the wagon. Congressman Clyburn has it almost exactly upside down. As you will see with the evidence I'll present to you, he has it almost completely reversed. For example, we hear about the top 1%. That's a big part of the Occupy Wall Street's rhetoric, the top 1%. Here's the top 1% in, I think, about 2009, according to the IRS's statistics. The top 1% are making about 18% of national income. All the money we earn in the United States, the top 1% are making about 18%. And they're paying about 40% of the tax. So the top 1% earn 18% of the income and pay 40% of the income tax, and yet we hear that they're not paying their fair share. I'm not quite sure what the fair share would be if you're making 18% of money and paying 40% of tax. Now, these following charts were done by yours truly with the assistance of my best friend and confidant, a Manhattan financier named Mr. Brett A. Schistler. He, by the way, was born in, believe it or not, Indianapolis, Indiana. So you're seeing the work of a son of Indianapolis here. And we took a look at a number of statistics regarding income tax and various taxes paid and how much the rich are paying and not paying. And on average, the average American taxpayer is paying about 20.4% income tax. The top 10% are paying almost 27% of that. The top 5% are paying about 28. And the top 1% are paying 29.5. And what you'll see in these charts over and over and over again is, generally speaking, the more money people make, the more tax they pay. Here you see the income tax revenue in 2008, the money actually collected by Uncle Sam through the IRS to pay for NASA, the Secret Service, the Smithsonian, Pell Grants, food stamps, everything the federal government does. That money brought in was $1.032 trillion. Of that amount of money raised by the IRS in income tax in 2008, the top 10% paid 70% of that, or $721 billion. The top 5% paid 59% of that sum, or $606 billion. And the top 1% of the $1.032 trillion raised by the IRS, they paid 38% of that amount of money, or $392 billion, just the top 1%. Now, how about the bottom 50%, the lower half of the income distribution in this country? They paid, out of that money raised by the IRS in income tax, a grand total of $28 billion, or about 3% of the money it takes to run the federal government, or 3% of the taxes raised to run the federal government. You look at effective tax rates on federal income tax, and again, if you're making about $20,000 to $30,000, you're paying about 2.5% effective tax. If you're in the middle making about $100,000, you're paying about 9.9%, 10%. And if you're making $1 million, you're paying an effective tax rate of 24.4% of your income. The more money you make, the more tax you pay. And here, some people say, well, okay, that's income tax. Great, Murdoch, that's income tax. What about payroll tax? What about all the other taxes people pay? You take a look at income, payroll, or Social Security tax, Medicare tax, corporate tax, death taxes. You put all that together. Here again, you find that people who are making about $20,000 to $30,000 are paying about 6% combined tax rate, and people are making $1 million are paying 29.1%. The more money people make, the more money people pay in tax. Now, what's interesting is the number of people who file tax returns but actually don't pay any taxes along with their tax returns. And in the year 2011, that was about 59 million people who send in their 1040 forms, but there's no check attached because they're not paying any actual money in tax. They're basically living free of federal tax. Scott Hodge, who's the president of the Tax Foundation, is very concerned about this, and he testified before the Senate Finance Committee in May of this year. And he said, we need to have a national discussion over whether it is fair or equitable to have millions of people enjoy the benefits of civil society but contribute nothing to its costs. I believe that it is bad for democracy and bad for the fiscal health of the nation to have so many Americans with no skin in the game. And he continued, good citizenship requires that we contribute at least something to the basic costs of government if we're going to enjoy the benefits of it, unquote. And I think this is a very important point. I think everybody in America should pay some tax, and it can be very small and modest if you're someone of modest means, but I think we all have to be in this together, and whether you're talking about what the CIA is doing or what the Secret Service is doing or what teachers are doing with the assistance of federal education, research grants, or whatever, this should be something in which we all share. And I think if everyone pays tax to a degree, that would be very good in that respect. The other flip side of it is, or the political danger, is if it turns out that we have a vote here, we decide that we're all going to have free health care, and we're going to have free medicine, and everybody gets a vacation house, and everybody gets a free ski trip to Aspen this year, if you're all good about it. And Mr. Marisotis here is kind enough to pay for it all. Who's in favor? All in favor, say aye. Very good. And we thank you for your generosity. We're getting to the point where we're going to have 51% of Americans being able to vote to have all sorts of goodies paid for by the other 49%. And when that happens and that gets tied into voting behavior and people develop that kind of a voting pattern, I think we're going to be well on our way to democratic socialism in the United States of America. And the basic thinking behind all of this, I think, is summarized very nicely by this cartoon where President Obama is speaking, and he says, I won't allow the half of Americans who pay no taxes to bear the burden of the other half who aren't paying their fair share. So if that makes sense to you, then you understand exactly what he's thinking. Here's our good friend Bernie Sanders again, who said, these people who are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe they've got to go back to the Bible or whatever they believe in, understanding that there is virtue in sharing and reaching out that you can't get it all. And again, the idea here is these awful, disgusting, nasty rich people are just not doing anything other than playing golf, probably hanging out on their yachts, drinking champagne, and eating caviar. That's all they do all day long. Well, this is very interesting because there's a study done every other year called the Study of High Net Worth Philanthropy. And this takes a look at what wealthy people actually do with their money. And this is done every other year, as I say, sponsored by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and it's done also by the Center on Philanthropy at the Indiana University. How about that? And they take a look every other year at wealthy people, and they specifically look at this most recent study at 800 respondents, all of whom have a household income greater than $200,000 and or net worth, excluding the value of their homes, of at least $1 million. And the average wealth of the respondents in this survey, 800 people, 10.7 million. So these are multimillionaires with a lot of money in their pockets. And they talk to 800 of them and ask them, okay, what do you do with your money when you give it away? And guess what? These awful, awful, greedy, nasty people, 98.2% of them, of these households, gave to charity, 98.2. Almost full 100% participation in philanthropy, or pretty close to it. Compare that to your regular general population. While the wealthy people, $10 million on average, are giving 98.2% of them are giving away their money, only about 65% of the general population does so. Now, I know a lot of people have bills to pay. They've got all sorts of responsibilities. We can excuse the other 35% if they can't afford it. But among the wealthy, 98.2% of these greedy bums actually support philanthropy. And what do they do with their money? One of the arguments is, oh, well, they give money to the ballet and the symphony so they can hang out with their rich friends. They do that. But guess what? The number one number one destination of the philanthropic giving of these multimillionaires, these very wealthy people, is basic needs. They're giving money to the Salvation Army. They're giving money to the Goodwill. They're giving money to the homeless shelters. They're giving money to people who are in desperate straits, people who are in distress, and people need help. That's the number one place by far where they give their money. The number two destination for their philanthropy, education, helping young people learn more, developing the skills so they can be productive American men and women. Number three is the arts. Yes, this is where they do give money to the symphony and the ballet and the opera and all that. So they do this, but this is number three on the list. They also give to religious organizations, health and medical research, youth and family services, environmental and animal care, and other things of this sort. And some of them even give away their vehicles, where they, rather than take a car to a used car lot, they give it to a charity and say, okay, you go sell it and you can keep the proceeds from that sale. These wealthy people also volunteer in enormous numbers. 78.7, almost 80% of them volunteered in the year 2009. Now, it's one thing to sit at your desk in some Fortune 100 company and write a check and drop it in the mail and say, okay, I've given my $1 million donation to the Crippled Children's Society, and so I've gotten rid of my capitalist guilt, and I'll go back to my capitalist greed and make a lot of money. That's easy to do. What's a lot harder to do is roll up your sleeves and go somewhere and actually give of your own energy and your own time and your own physical being to support the causes in which you believe. And it turns out, according to this survey, that the average high net worth individual volunteered 307 hours in 2009. 307 hours. Now, for those of you who are trying to do the math, I'll spare you. 307 hours of average time volunteered by each one of these wealthy people, high-income individuals, equals 38 eight-hour shifts or 13 donated 24-hour days. This would be the equivalent of somebody with $10 million walking into charity hospital on January 1st of this year and working nonstop for 13 days until January 13th and finally going home on January 14th, or coming in for 38 eight-hour shifts of volunteer time. And again, that's a lot more difficult, and that shows a lot more personal sacrifice than just writing a check and dropping a check in the mail, although there's nothing wrong with that. Some of these high-net-worth individuals include people like Ken Langone. Ken Langone is the founder or co-founder of Home Depot, a very wealthy man. He's a billionaire. He also was on the board of trustees of the New York Stock Exchange. And Ken Langone decided to give a gift of $200 million, $200 million to New York University. And there was one string attached to New York University Medical Center, and he said, you may do whatever you want with this money, one caveat, please put my name on the front door. So it's now known as the Ken Langone NYU Medical Center. Apart from that, they can do what they wish, and using that money to develop their facilities, build better medical centers, train medical students, and provide the kind of cures that make people feel better and live longer. $200 million gift, just please put my name on the front door. This very elegant lady here is Dorothy Chandler, or was Dorothy Chandler. I don't believe she's with us anymore. She was the heiress to the Times Mirror of Fortune, the people who published the Times, LA Times, until the Tribune Company took it over. And she's living, obviously, quite elegantly and comfortably here. She donated something called the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion to the people of Los Angeles, and this is somewhere we can go and hear the opera and hear watch ballet and see all sorts of dance productions and so on. And this was the home of the Academy Awards for many years. For many, many years, the Oscars were held here before they were moved on to the Shrine Auditorium and then to the Kodak Theater in Hollywood, where they're held today. This is Andrew Carnegie, one of the great robber barons, as they were called, of the 19th century, a man who made a lot of money selling steel to the railroads so they could put in the rails that linked our country together in the 19th century. He made a lot of cash, and then he decided to donate this. Anybody know what this is? This is Carnegie Hall, right in New York City, one of the great cultural meccas of the United States of America, given to the people of New York by Andrew Carnegie. Very nice gift. And by the way, it's still up and running today. Now, not all of these wealthy individuals are very nice people. This is Henry Ford. Henry Ford was an irascible man. He also was a major anti-Semite, and he was also a pro-Hitler before World War II. So not a very nice fellow. But despite his own personal darkness, he did a lot of good for a lot of people because of his work and his industry. First and foremost, by creating something called the Model T. Prior to the development of the Model T, most Americans were born, lived, and died within about 20 miles or so of where they were born. The Model T made it possible for people to leave where they grew up and go explore the rest of the country and made mobility something completely central to the American experience. And these cars were affordable enough so regular middle-class folks could buy them. Prior to the Model T, the only people who had cars were wealthy people who had Daimler-Benz touring cars and horseless carriages, as they were called, and you had to have a lot of money for that. Henry Ford made it possible for regular folks to have cars. He also created the assembly line, which is something which obviously was very helpful to all sorts of industries, not just the auto industry, and created opportunities for thousands and thousands of people, such as those outside this Ford Motor Company plant in Detroit and in cities, not just in Detroit, but around the country. And even today, Ford makes fantastic products, such as this beautiful Mustang. It didn't end with the Model T. They make great cars today. Now, what did the Fords do with all that auto money? They created something called the Ford Foundation, and this is the Ford Foundation headquarters on 42nd Street in New York City. It has a beautiful atrium inside. You can walk in and look at all these beautiful, all the beautiful foliage they have in there. It's open to the public. And the Ford Foundation was started with a gift of $25,000 from Henry Ford and his son Edsel Ford, after whom the Edsel vehicle is named. And the gift was designated, quote, to be used all for the public welfare, unquote. And they began giving away their money. 1958, $25 million to Lincoln Center, which now is a thriving cultural institution in New York City with the Metropolitan Opera, the Symphony, all sorts of plays and theatrical productions, jazz at Lincoln Center. It's a wonderful place. When you're in New York City, you should drop by and visit. $25 million in Ford Foundation money made that possible. in the 1960s. They helped launch groups such as MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, National Council of La Raza, and other groups which are interested in ethnic advancement for minorities. 1982, they helped launch something called the National Council for Research on Women. 1983, they donated money to 283 national public radio stations. Just last year, they gave $25 million to HIV/AIDS research. And in 2009, they gave away $490 million, almost a half a billion dollars given away by the Ford Foundation. And as I was going through those various causes they've supported, you may have noticed that you didn't see a lot of money to the Heritage Foundation or the Cato Institute or the Hoover Institution or any groups of this sort. The Ford Foundation is more or less the Fort Knox of the left. And they give a lot of money to left-of-center organizations. And I think it's very ironic that many of the people on the left who scream and yell and rant and rave about rich people also are funded through the money that the Ford family and the Ford Foundation put into the Ford, Ford family put into the Ford Foundation, and they're essentially enjoying the benefits of the wealth of this very rich family. In fact, Henry Ford II, who was on the board of the Ford Foundation, and he resigned because he was very upset about the leftward drift of the Ford Foundation, and he said the following in his letter of resignation. "The Ford Foundation exists and thrives on the fruits of our economic system. The dividends of competitive enterprise make it all possible. A significant portion of the abundance created by United States business enables the foundation and like institutions to carry on their work. In effect, the foundation is a creature of capitalism, a statement that I'm sure would be shocking to many professional staff people in the field of philanthropy," said Henry Ford II, January of 1977. I also think it's kind of funny when you hear about corporate greed from the Occupy Wall Street crowd. I don't know if you can read this very well, but here's some protesters going down the street. And they've got one guy wearing a hat from J. Crew. Another one has a camera by Sony. Somebody's holding up a protest sign that, of course, is poster board by Weyerhaeuser. Somebody's got dyed hair from Clairol, makeup from Procter & Gamble, T-shirt from The Gap. And it says at the end, we deserve more from these greedy corporations. Join us afterwards at Starbucks. So the Occupy Wall Street people would be marching down the street naked if it were not for these greedy corporations. Now, I kind of get a kick out of this picture here. This is a picture from Great Britain in the late 60s. And the man, the tall man in the bowler is John Cleese, who went on to great fame and fortune as a member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And the two other gentlemen are a pair of comedians known as the Two Ronnies, a comedy duo from Great Britain. And I use this photo as a funny way of illustrating the idea that when people say we need equality, 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 I believe in equality before the law. I believe we should be equal as citizens. I don't believe in income equality, and this is not something we ought to be pursuing any more than trying to make everybody equal in terms of height. Imagine if we were all the same height. It would make for a less interesting country and planet, and it would probably be very painful for those being either pushed or pulled into whatever the proper height might be. And this, again, echoes something which we hear from a lot of politicians on the left, such as James Clyburn of South Carolina. "The gap continues to grow wider between those who enjoy great wealth and those who struggle to get by with little thought of ever getting ahead. It's all about the income gap, the gap, the gap." We always hear about this idea. So let's do a little thought experiment. Let's say that you're in the job market and you're looking for a job and you're entertaining two job offers. In the first job offer, you would get $50,000 and your boss would make $55,000. So you have an income gap there of about 10%, which is not so bad. That's pretty rough, if not equal, not very unequal, only 10% inequality. Then you do another interview and you're given this job offer with a different organization. You make $500,000, but your boss makes $1 million. The inequality is now 100%. That greedy SOB is making twice as much money as you are, and that's not fair. Now, all those in favor of job offer A, let's applaud. And all those who would take job offer B, let's hear your applause. I think the point in this simple illustration is it's not about the income gap. I'm not interested in the income gap. I'm tired of hearing about the income gap. The important thing is, what are we going to do with the people at the bottom on the floor, and how are we going to get them up? I'm not interested in yanking people out of their penthouses and out of their mansions and letting them run down the alleys naked, which people in the Occupy Wall Street movement seem to be interested in doing. I want to know, what are we going to do with those people who are on sidewalks and who are in ghettos and who are in government housing and who are not living well and living check to check or without checks if they're not even working? And how do we lift them up? I'd much rather live in a society where we have this gap here with people on the ground much higher, even though there are people up higher than they are, who are wealthy, than what I think other people want, which is to have a very close gap with the poor and the rich or people wealthier than them, much further down down the income scale, much more equal but also much, much poorer. That is a very depraved viewpoint and something which I do not support, and I'm very saddened and horrified to hear major American politicians who should know better preaching this sort of thing. Winston Churchill put this very well when he said, "The inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings. The inherent virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of miseries." Anybody know what that is on the screen? This is Korea. This is Korea, taken from a satellite way up ahead. It looks like New Jersey, but that's actually the Korean Peninsula. So this is the Korean Peninsula by day, and here's the Korean Peninsula by night. And in South Korea, you have income inequality. You have people who are poor, you have people who are rich, you have people living in penthouse apartments and mansions, you have people living in one-bedroom apartments or studios, people probably sleeping on their mom and dad's sofas. How unfair. And yet the sun goes down and the lights come on, and you can see the exciting lights of Seoul, you can see the lights of Busan, the whole southern half of that peninsula is alive and vibrant and energetic. And in the north, you have income equality. I mean, it's true, the Kim Jong-il family is living in their palace, and they're living large, but everyone else is pretty equal. You know, there's not a big gap between somebody on one corner and somebody across the street. They're living pretty equally. And so if you want income equality, there it is. And if you're not bothered by the idea of income inequality, there you are. I think this particular illustration summarizes quite well the stakes that face us and the kind of where these ideas take us eventually to a really dark place, I'm afraid. I very much like words that have been attributed to Abraham Lincoln. "You cannot strengthen the weak by weakening the strong. You cannot help the poor man by destroying the rich. You cannot further the brotherhood of man by inciting class hatred." Those were very, very wise words then and very wise words today. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll give DeRoy just a second here to catch his breath before we begin in the questions. I want to remind you to please use the white cards on your table if you have a question for our speaker. And for those of you on Twitter, please direct message us at EconomicClubIN or use that hashtag. For those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, please continue using your Nokia flip phone. Let me take the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question here. You mentioned the role of philanthropy. I run a national foundation. What is our responsibility in philanthropy, DeRoy, in terms of addressing some of the challenges that you've talked about? Is philanthropy going to solve the problems of our society? Is philanthropy a catalyst for change? What's our role in this?
That's a very good question. I work with a lot of think tanks. As I mentioned, the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, first and foremost among them, and we are very much relying upon philanthropists to help us do our work. And I think philanthropists, either on an individual basis or as large organizations like yours, can be very helpful. In some cases, providing direct assistance to people who are poor and need help, funding things like medical research for people who are looking for cures, and in some cases doing the academic research that will show, well, this particular approach works, this approach does not. One thing that I would like to see philanthropists do that I think would be very, very helpful. We talked about this at lunch. I would love to see somebody fund something that I like to call the exit interview project. And that is to ask CEOs and CFOs and people who run big companies or even small ones, when you leave New York State and move to Texas, or you leave California and go to Arizona, or for that matter, you leave the United States and move to China or India or Mexico, what have you, why are you doing so? Why are you getting up and leaving your facility with 100, 200, 300, 5,000 workers, as it may be, and going to another country or to another state, as the case may be, and leaving those people behind? Is it tax, too much tax? Is it difficult regulations? Is it a punitive labor environment? Is it the education system? Is it something else that we aren't even thinking about? And if we could get a sense from people who actually go to the step of either leaving their state, or even more amazingly, if you think about it, getting up and leaving the United States of America and going to a country on the other side of the planet, about a 14, 15, 16-hour flight away, other side of the planet, where they don't speak English, they don't even use Roman letters, and they're putatively communist. Things have got to be pretty serious for you to make that step, I think. And we ought to be self-reflective and ask, why are people doing this? And if we could stop doing the things that are scaring away, maybe we'd have more opportunity here, more jobs could stay in this country, more jobs could be created in this country, we'd have more opportunity, less poverty, and less of the problems that we are trying to solve today and in the work that you do.
Very good. Let me try to get to as many of these questions as possible. There's some really great questions coming in, including on Twitter, I'll have you know, which I'm following right here. One question that we had, you mentioned the healthcare reform, the healthcare in general, and of course we know the Supreme Court is taking up the healthcare reform law. Do you have any sense or any predictions about how that will go? And maybe more importantly, what do you think are the factors that are going to go into that decision as they debate that case?
That's very interesting. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to play one on television here or at the podium. I'll just speculate a little bit. I've heard a number of wise people say that they believe that the individual mandate will be tossed out because it just takes the Commerce Clause too far. And it's one thing to say if you engage in interstate commerce, the government can regulate you. If you actually do not engage in an activity, you don't do whatever it is, and you basically engage in non-activity, how can the government regulate non-activity? So if you don't buy insurance, how can you possibly be regulated if there is no purchase to be made in the first place? And so I've heard a number of wise people say they think that will be thrown out. They think that the Supreme Court, because they often parse things and sort of negotiate among themselves, might throw that out, but keep much of the rest of the law. Now, if that happens, it'd essentially be like having saying, okay, well, sir, you can keep your car, but we're going to take out the transmission. If you don't have an individual mandate, I don't know how you fund this thing, and I think it just sputters and stops, but the government will still have a lot of ability to regulate a lot of things and will. So I think that's some of what will go into it, what will be dealt with. Another big question, and it seems like it won't happen, is whether Justice Kagan will recuse herself. And there's some evidence that she was engaged in some discussions about the Health Care Act as was being debated, and if so, should she now still rule on that? She actually recused herself in a case just a couple of days ago. I don't know if she will in this one as well, which would be quite interesting.
We've gotten several questions that have some commonality here, so let me try to just pick one that sort of captures the essence of one of these questions, which is actually one of the Twitter questions. Would you comment on the corporate boards who cut jobs but give themselves bonuses?
Interesting. Well, that's nothing I think anybody likes to see happen. I think that there are economic reasons to do that, which is if you have a company that is not profitable and you can't pay your employees, you've got to do something. And unfortunately, one of the effective things to do is cut personnel. I do think it would be prudent for them to say, all right, look, you know, they're sacrificing by losing their jobs, and we ought to do the same thing and at least deny ourselves our bonuses. I think there's a difference between saying, here's the way a company should behave, and that's how I would behave if I were running a company, and then saying the government must come in and say, okay, you may not do that. I think the government we run into big problems where we have the government tell companies to do that sort of thing, and once they tell them to do that sort of thing, then they can say, okay, here's how much money you ought to be paid, and we're going to make a lot of other decisions for you. Ultimately, when private companies run, the board should make these decisions, but I think it's wise, particularly if they're laying people off, that they try to share in the pain and at least deny themselves bonuses. That's how I would run a company if I were doing so.
Here's an interesting question. If everyone would have to pay the same tax as you advocate, would that be considered a tax increase by those who currently aren't paying taxes?
That is a very good question. Yes, that's a very good question, and I do believe everybody has to pay something, and if you have 50% of the people not paying any income tax, then I guess that would be a tax increase. I think it could be a modest sum like $100. I mean, it's just as long as everybody's involved to a degree. I'd be curious to hear what my friend Grover Norquist would say about that. And I would imagine, though, that if we did have something where everybody paid, the top rate would be way, way down, like 15%, where it should be. I was in Hong Kong about 3 weeks ago, and they have essentially a flat tax where you pay either 17% of your net income or 15% of your gross income, whichever is lower. You pay the lower of the two. And then they have a flat corporate tax of 16.5%. The place is absolutely thriving. I walked around for a week in many neighborhoods. I saw a grand total of four street-level commercial retail vacancies, four shop fronts closed up, you know, available for rent or for lease. I walked around my neighborhood in New York City. I live in the East Village, which is a pretty lively part of town. I counted 12 such vacancies within a five-minute radius of my apartment. The unemployment rate in Hong Kong, 3.2%. So the argument I'd make by analogy here is if we did have even a situation where everyone paid something, we closed a lot of loopholes, we brought the rates down, and we had a situation where people paid a much lower rate of tax, even with higher participation, you'd have a much more thriving economy, and even people who had to start paying some tax likely would be going back to work and making income and thriving.
We've got time maybe for just one or two more questions. I can't let you go without asking you a political question since you're someone who's so involved. Your fellow columnist Charles Krauthammer recently said that the political pendulum swing of the 2010 election is now reversing itself and that the upcoming presidential and congressional elections could now go either way. Do you agree or disagree with that assessment and why?
That's very interesting. I think that there could be some truth to that. I think that the real key here is how energized the political left will be. And I've heard grumbling from people on the left who are not very happy with President Obama. They think he's not gone left enough. I think he's gone too far left. They think he needs to keep going. And if they feel that and stay home, I think that people on the right who are not at all pleased with President Obama will show up in sufficient numbers so that he can go to Chicago and open his presidential library soon. I'll be happy to be the first person in line to go visit that library. I think that if the left does get energized and they go to the mattresses, as they say, I think that could prove very well for President Obama. And I think a lot of it also depends on how energized the right is. And I think there's some grumbling now that the House GOP leadership is nowhere as energetic in cutting spending and as creative and so on as many of us would like. So I think a lot of it depends on intensity and turnout, and a lot of that depends on what sort of policies we see enacted over the next 6 months or so.
Please join me in thanking DeRoy Murdoch. Let me conclude by thanking, again, our luncheon sponsor, the IU Kelley School of Business Evening MBA program, and to all of our platinum sponsors for helping to make this afternoon possible. Our next luncheon will be on Wednesday, January 18th, featuring economist Dr. Arthur Laffer. Thank you all very much for coming.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.